Welcome back to the DeCesare Group Podcast. I'm your host, Jim DeCesare. What an honor it is to have this week's guest, Brigadier General Dan Cherry. This is someone I've wanted to have on the podcast for a long time. General Cherry had a distinguished 29-year career in the United States Air Force, where he was a fighter pilot, a Vietnam veteran, and commander of the Air Force Thunderbirds. He has an incredible story of reconciliation from his time in the Vietnam War. We talk about that story and how what happened on that day back in 1972 is at the heart of the creation of the Aviation Heritage Park, where General Cherry currently serves as Director Emeritus. Dan Cherry also served as president of the Kentucky Trans Park, a flagship economic development project in South Central Kentucky, and he served as secretary of the Kentucky Justice Cabinet. He's an incredibly civic-minded individual who has contributed so much to our community. Here's my conversation with General Dan Cherry. General Cherry, welcome to the DeCesare Group Podcast.
Thank you, Jim.
Hey, it's so good to see you. Let's start off with the Aviation Heritage Park. First of all, congratulations. I understand a ninth plane is currently being refurbished. Tell us what the park offers and tell us about this new attraction that you're going to have.
Well, Jim, we're very excited about this latest exhibit, basically. It's an F-105 Thunder Chief, and that particular airplane is very special to me because in my early days as an Air Force pilot, it's the airplane I flew. Okay. And it was the...
Is it the exact plane or like the plane?
Well, I have flown this very airplane though,
wow,
in my career. But when I first graduated from pilot training, I selected the F-105 and... For a lot of good reasons, I guess, but the most compelling reason for me for selecting that as my assignment was the fact that it looked cool.
Well, of course.
And that's a measure of my maturity back at that time. But so this is in the 1960s.
Okay, how old were you in 1960? When you were doing your training?
I was in my 20s.
Okay.
Yeah.
You were a young fella.
I was a young fella. But back in those days, when you went to Air Force pilot training, you if there were, say, 30 people in your class, then as you graduated, the class would be ranked from first in the class all the way to number 30.
Mm-hmm.
And the Air Force would send down the number of assignments of all of the pilots in your class. If you were number one in the class, you got to pick from all 30,
okay,
whatever kind of airplane that was in that list. And
is number 30 like flying a crop duster or?
it just depends on what's left. It depends,
yeah,
on what was of interest to people.
Yeah.
And generally, the fighter airplanes go first.
Mm-hmm.
Deliberations to figure out where I was going to go after pilot training. I had worked really hard in pilot training and was very fortunate to end up being number one. And so I got to pick from everything. And there were and I'm saying 30, it wasn't exactly 30 people, but about that number. Of that 30, there were only about six fighter assignments. The rest were either to bombers, airlift aircraft, helicopters, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I desperately wanted to fly fighters. I just did.
Yeah.
And of the fighter assignments that were offered up, there were two of them that were F-105s. And like I said, my scientific analysis told me that the 105 was the coolest looking airplane, so I chose that.
That's awesome.
But it really, really ended up being a wonderful choice for me. My first assignment ended up being over in Germany flying the F-105, and I learned a lot about being a fighter pilot in that environment. Very difficult in terms of weather.
Mm-hmm.
The F-105 is a handful to fly, too, compared to what I flew in pilot training. So it was a big transition, but I managed to get through it okay, and I loved every minute of being able to fly that 105. So, but back to Aviation Heritage Park, this F-105 that we have now that's pending restoration, but it's there and viewable from anybody that visits. They can see the airplane. But that particular airplane is an F-105F, which means it's a two-seater.
Mm-hmm.
The two-seaters were used as ways to instruct brand new pilots to the F-105. After I finished my first combat tour in 1967 in the 105, I came back to McConnell Air Force Base and flew the F-105 again as an instructor.
Okay.
And this particular airplane, tail number 343, was in my squadron.
How about that?
And I went back and looked at my flight records, and sure enough, I've flown this very airplane 8 times.
Wow.
And this is back in the early 70s.
So where is McConnell? 60.
McConnell's in Wichita, Kansas.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Wichita, Kansas.
And so this plane is being rehabilitated.
It is.
Is it inside that hangar building, or is it outside?
It's not. It's outside right now. Mm-hmm. We're doing some maintenance work on one of our earlier exhibits in the restoration tent right now. But the airplane is sitting there so that everybody can see and understand what we go through to restore an aircraft like this to exhibit standards.
Mm-hmm.
We're very proud of the fact that we have very high standards. The Air Force has acknowledged that. And as you may know, Jim, all the airplanes we have actually are still owned by the sponsoring service. So this particular F-105 belongs to the Air Force, but it's on permanent loan to Aviation Heritage Park. And as long as we maintain it and take care of it like we should, it'll be ours forever. So that's kind of where we are with it. But it's basically there as a sort of an informal display, and we're excited that people over time are going to see the process of restoration and how difficult that is, and the work that we put into every single exhibit we have.
What's a timeline on a project like that?
It'll probably be, with the other work that we have to do, it'll be at least a year.
Okay.
And as we get close to being able, as the weather improves, you know, we can do more work when the weather's good.
Sure.
The different steps we take in getting it prepared, and any kind of minor damage to it that gets repaired, and then getting it prepared for a paint job.
Mm-hmm.
It'll all be visible to anyone who comes to Aviation Heritage Park and visits.
So all this work will be done on site.
It will.
That's awesome.
It sure will. In the past, you know, we did most of our restoration at the Bowling Green Airport, and then we would, in the middle of the night on a Sunday night, we'd pull the airplane down Three Springs Road,
right,
which was pretty exciting.
With Jody Richards in the cockpit.
That's right. That's exactly right. We did that with the F-4, very first airplane. We sure did.
So tell us about the park. What does the park offer?
Well, it offers way more today than...
It's come a long way.
Well, it has, and we're so proud of that fact. But it's always been an attraction for young people. It's so gratifying to us when we're out there working on, whether we're working on the landscaping or whatever we're doing, cleaning up one of the exhibits. It's very gratifying to see how many parents and grandparents bring their children out there. It's pretty unusual. You know, we kind of take it for granted,
sure.
But it's pretty unusual that a young person can actually walk up and touch an airplane like we have out there, or a helicopter. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that I think has really added to the success of Aviation Heritage Park is that every single artifact that we have, every aircraft, tells a true story about a real person from our community.
Yeah.
And so a young person can come up and say, look at the T-33, and say, gosh, that person, you know, went to school here.
Now, what's a T-33 for those of us that don't know?
The T-33 is the aircraft we have to honor General Russell Doherty. General Doherty was a 4-star Air Force general. A wonderful gentleman, grew up in Glasgow, Kentucky, and is a part of the Hall of Distinguished Alumni at Western Kentucky University. He was a wonderful man.
Mm-hmm.
And so he loved flying the T-33, and we were able to get a T-33 and honor him in that way.
That's awesome. And I know you have a helicopter, a Marine helicopter, I think Mac Reynolds flew.
That's correct.
And then you've got Terry Wilkett's the training plane. Is that right?
That's right. The T-38 Talon is still today the primary training airplane for the United States Air Force. So everybody that goes through Air Force pilot training today flies the T-38.
Okay.
In addition to that, NASA maintains a fleet of T-38s that are used for the astronauts to do their special travel when they have to go to a aviation contractor somewhere in the country. Mm-hmm. It also is used in some of the initial training for being able to fly the shuttle. And NASA airplanes are just, they maintain them and they're beautiful. We were very fortunate to get one just because when the shuttle program was disbanded, mm-hmm. NASA realized they didn't need as many T-38s as they had kept. And so they took two or three of them that were of the highest flying time, the ones that had the most wear and tear, and put them in the boneyard out in Tucson, Arizona. And we were watching that very carefully because we knew we wanted an airplane to represent Terry Wilkett's career. Mm-hmm. And we knew we'd never get a shuttle to do that. But the T-38 was something we had our eye on. We found out that this particular airplane was out in the boneyard in Tucson, Arizona. And we went through all the bureaucratic hoops we needed to. Ended up that we won the competition, and the airplane then was put on loan to us. After we got the T-38, we discovered with all the records that NASA gave us that every astronaut you have ever heard of has flown this very airplane.
Really?
And of course, the one we were most concerned about is Terry Wilkett, our honoree.
Yeah.
And he's flown it three or four times, as I recall. So we have great records of who flew this airplane, but it makes it so historic. And honestly, Jim, I think if some of the larger museums had known of the unique history of this particular T-38,
yeah,
we probably wouldn't have been able to compete for it,
but they didn't. And when you say the astronauts we've all heard of, are you talking like the Apollo astronauts?
Yes, and the Mercury astronauts.
Okay.
John Glenn.
Gus Grissom, folks like that.
Exactly. Okay. You can't name one that hasn't flown.
Alan Shepard.
Yep. You can't name an astronaut that hasn't flown this very airplane.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, and the airplane right now, as we open the new museum building at Aviation Heritage Park, that particular T-38 now is indoors, actually in the museum. And if I do say so, it just looks beautiful in there with the lighting as it is, and it sets the tone of the whole, all the exhibits in the museum.
It does have a unique paint job. I've actually seen that one up close, and it's hard to describe, but it's kind of white. It's got a kind of a sparkle to it.
Well, it does. And that's thanks to our hardworking guys that do the restoration of mm-hmm. the airplanes. But another thing we're always very concerned about, we want the airplanes to be authentic. Mm-hmm. So we do a great deal of research to be sure that the markings on the airplane are truly correct. Mm-hmm. And that's the case with this T-38. It is basically a white airplane. And it, like you say, it shines, it's beautiful, and yeah, it's got the blue stripe down the side. NASA had a unique paint scheme. Mm-hmm. And so this airplane, we've duplicated that paint scheme perfectly. It looks great, and it particularly looks great in the indoor environment.
Yeah. You know, I remember when the Marine One helicopter, I remember the summer, I believe, was that one flown in?
No, it wasn't.
Okay.
No, it wasn't. It came from Jacksonville, Florida.
Okay.
And we had some help with a couple of different companies to help us truck it in, but it came in on two flatbed trailers.
Okay.
Again, that's been a great addition because it gives us also, along with honoring Mac Reynolds, mm-hmm. A local, wonderful Marine Corps officer, It gives us a Marine Corps asset, which we didn't have before.
Right.
So now we have basically all the services represented. We don't have the Coast Guard yet, but we probably will at some point in time.
Yeah.
But we have that particular helicopter, and the Navy gave us permission to paint it in presidential colors, because I think you know, Jim, that Mac Reynolds had, during his Marine Corps career, he had two different tours as a presidential pilot, flying that particular airplane.
I believe one was George W. Bush, but I don't know the other.
Yes, that's correct, and President Clinton as well.
Okay.
And then as vice president, he flew President George Bush the first.
Yeah.
Herbert Walker. As well. Yeah, Herbert Walker Bush. Yeah.
Under Reagan's
that's
tenure.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. All right, how many planes and aircraft do you have out there now?
Well, we've got we have now, actually, with the F-105, we have 8
okay.
total airplanes. They are all exhibited out of doors except for 2. Mm-hmm. I've already talked about the T-38 honoring Terry Wilcutt,
right.
and all the NASA astronauts. We also have a Piper Cub to honor Willa Brown. Now, Willa Brown was a true aviation pioneer. She was born in Glasgow, Kentucky, lived there till she was, I think, 7 or 8 years old, and then the family moved up to near Chicago.
Okay.
But a true aviation pioneer. She is the first African-American woman to obtain a pilot's license in the United States.
Wow.
She also went on to be officially certified as an aircraft mechanic. She could do all of these things, and she ended up being an instructor pilot in a flight school near Chicago. And she flew primarily the Piper Cub, which is the exact airplane we have. We have a Piper Cub. And it's, again, painted just like the ones she flew. And the other thing that was significant about her career, in those days, there weren't many flight schools in our country that would admit African-American
yeah.
men to training. And there was one in Chicago and one in Los Angeles. And Willa became an instructor at the one in Chicago, and the young African-American men that she was training, most of them went on to Tuskegee, Alabama, and became the core of the Tuskegee Airmen that distinguished themselves so well in World War II.
Right. That's just amazing, the amount of history we have right here in South
Isn't
Central
it?
Kentucky.
I agree. I mean, who would have thought that? And, you know, when we first started Aviation Heritage Park, that's what really gave us the courage to do something, I guess, when we found my particular F-4 airplane. And I remember at the time whether we should do anything like a heritage park or a museum or anything like that. I was apprehensive about that because I thought it could be seen as very self-serving.
Yeah.
But then Ray Buckberry, my good friend and retired attorney here in town.
Yep.
I know you know Ray. Ray is quite a local historian, as you may know.
Yeah.
And he started telling us about this incredible aviation heritage. And it is remarkable that a town our size
yeah.
has so many distinguished aviators attached to it.
Yeah.
And so it's been great being able to honor them. The other spinoff benefit that we never anticipated was getting to know the families of our honorees.
Yeah.
Such as General Doherty, you know, and Colonel Ray Nutter, and Mac Reynolds. I mean,
yeah.
You know, a lot of our honorees have passed.
Yeah.
Johnny Magda that flew with the Blue Angels, and who was sadly killed in action in the Korean War. But we've been able to get to know their families, their children, their grandchildren. And they are so thankful, so appreciative, and it's been a wonderful experience getting to know them.
And before we talk about your plane, You know, I believe, you can correct me if I'm wrong, the head of Space Force has a Bowling Green connection.
Sure does.
Yeah. So, yes. You know, there are still active connections in aviation history.
No question.
Yeah.
No question about it. Certainly, and if you expand, you know, our scope, which we have basically to include South Central Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
we've still been able to stick with that, and we're still overwhelmed with people that are very, very eligible for being an honoree at Aviation Heritage Park.
Well, is that something that you all are doing or are going to do, to where you have like a South Central Kentucky Hall of Fame for the Aviation Heritage?
We do, and we are doing that, and mm-hmm. we continue to add to that. We don't call it a Hall of Fame, but basically they are candidates, as we look at it, to be honored by a specific exhibit in the museum somewhere.
Yeah. You might not be able to get their plane, but you can get other stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so we're always looking for that. And as a matter of fact, we have an exhibit that shows a bit of their history, their careers, and a photograph or two. So when anybody comes to the museum and visit, you can see all of the people that we have essentially waiting in the wings to be honored with a full-fledged exhibit at some time in the future. We're not short of good aviators here, Jim.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how that started or why, but I'm thankful for it.
Well, and I know the group of individuals that are sort of the backbone of the Aviation Heritage Park, they're not short of willingness to go out there and find that information and honor those folks as well. So that's awesome.
Well, it is. You know, and that brings up another subject I like to talk about whenever I can. Our original core group of people had this idea in the first place is still with us. We've lost several, you know, that have passed away and that, but still there's a core group of good friends of mine and that are still very passionate about what we're doing and still helping out as much as they can, and that makes me feel good.
So this kind of all the Aviation Heritage Park kind of came about because of a field trip that maybe some of you all took to an Air Force museum in Dayton, Ohio, where you discovered an F-4 Phantom about 20 miles away at a VFW. Tell us that story.
Well, you just told the story.
Well, I'm sure there's more to it.
Well, you know, we do have an early morning walking group, and cleverly we've named it The Walking Group.
Yeah, my book club's The Book Club.
Yeah, The Book Club or your DeSesri Group podcast we're on. But you know, it's a group of men, and we get together early every 5 days a week anyway, every morning, and we go for a very fast 3-mile walk, and then we go to McDonald's and drink coffee and solve the problems of the world.
Sure.
And along with walking and getting our exercise and having the interaction with each other that we enjoy, occasionally we'll take a field trip together. And so this is back in 2008. And the group of the walking group was after me to set up something because they all wanted to go to the Air Force Museum in Dayton. And I think I was the only one that had ever been to it at that time. So I set up a special tour. We rented a van, and our whole plan was to have a guys' weekend. And we were going to take the van, go to Dayton, see the museum, and then come back home through Cincinnati to see a baseball game.
Sure.
And you just make it a nice guys' weekend. So had all that arranged, and we took off, went to Dayton. And as we arrived at the museum and walked in the front door, there were museum staff members there to greet us and brought us in. And they had a special docent that walked us around and told us about all the exhibits in that museum. And as we were doing that, he brought up the fact that he said, you know, General Cherry, that there's an airplane not far from here that has historic significance to Kentucky. And then as the conversation continued, what we discovered was the airplane he was talking about was my airplane. Mm-hmm. So every airplane has a tail number, and it's very visible on the paint job of an airplane. And the tail number of my F-4 that I flew in Vietnam was 550. And so as we continued to talk to the staff member as we're walking around the museum, he said, yeah, it's not far from here. It's in a little town of Enon, Ohio, and it's sitting on display in front of a VFW club. And it just might need a new home. And so we found out a little bit more about it. We finished our tour of the museum, and then all any we could talk about, we said, well, we've got to find the little town of Enon. Yeah. We've got to find Dan's airplane before we go to this ball game in Cincinnati. Yeah. So anyway, got our map out and figured out where Enon was, and drove into the little town and stopped at Minute Mart and said, well, where's your VFW club? And the guy in there directed us down this little country lane. And we took off and went down this windy country road, and then looked over there, and there she was sitting in the grass.
Wow.
And as we got closer, it became evident that the reason the Air Force was unhappy about the situation, and that staff member said something about it needing a new home, was the fact that the airplane had been really neglected. The VFW club was responsible for it, but they weren't taking care of it as they should. And so as we got closer, I was delighted to see it all in one piece, because it was sitting there, painted gray at the time, as opposed to in the Vietnam era, they were painted a green and brown camouflage right. color. And so in its later years, it was painted gray, mm-hmm. but it was covered with bird poop. The tires were flat. Grass was growing up all around it. Mm-hmm. It was ugly. I mean, it was ugly, but it was all in one piece.
Yeah.
So all we could talk about on the way home was, what can we do to help the Air Force find a home for it? And, you know, nobody had an idea of establishing or bringing it to Bowling Green at that point. Or establishing something like Aviation Heritage Park. But then, as we learned from Ray Buckberry, what a incredible heritage we have of aviators here in Bowling Green, then the thought moved to, well, maybe we should bring it here,
yeah.
if the Air Force will let us, and if we could make Dan's airplane sort of the cornerstone of an educational facility. So that two things: one, you keep these stories alive, mm-hmm. so that they don't just die somewhere, and then the other thing, inspire young people to maybe careers in aviation, or just to careers in the military or something like that, be an inspiration to young people.
Or just take interest in history.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. Take interest in
history. I got a question. When you're on this tour in Dayton, Ohio, and the docent mentions this plane, what kind of emotions did you have at that moment, thinking, this could be my plane?
Well, I knew it was my plane when he mentioned the tail number.
Right.
And I'll tell you where the emotions really came to the surface, Jim, was once we got out to that VFW club, mm-hmm. and we walked up around it. And I don't think I'd ever told anybody, maybe I told my wife or something, but I hadn't told friends or anything, any kind of details about the dogfight I was in with that airplane.
Right.
And, of course, all the guys that I'm with, and our group that went up there, we had, I think, 7 people.
Mm-hmm.
And they were asking me all kinds of questions about the airplane. And on the side of the airplane, traditionally, if an airplane is victorious in aerial combat, a symbol is painted on the side of it that stays there for the life of the airplane,
mm-hmm.
and it's the symbol of the enemy country.
Right.
And in this case, it was a red star representing the country of North Vietnam. And that star was still on that airplane that day. So I had to go through the details of the dogfight, and that was a very emotional time for me to
sure.
do that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was. But I was so glad to see that the airplane was not destroyed. You know, we've talked about, you and I have talked, I know, Jim, about how a lot of the steps in this whole story seem providential.
Yeah.
And that someone, someplace is guiding this story. And I believe that's true because there are too many amazing things happened for it to be just a pure coincidence.
Yeah, I mean, what are the odds that you and your buddies take a tour of an air museum and
exactly
find out about your plane, which, you know, talking about the dogfight, that prompted you finding this plane to pursue finding Hong Mi.
Well, it did. And, you know, once we came home and our whole group that traveled up there pretty much stayed together as the initial board of Aviation Heritage Park. We formed a nonprofit corporation and made an official application for the Air Force to loan us the airplane. And sure enough, it was successful. And so then we were faced with the chore of figuring out how to pay for getting it shipped down here. And then where are we going to put it? What are we going to do with it? You know, all that. All of these things had to be decided. But everybody never lost their passion for the idea. An educational facility and let Dance Plane be the cornerstone.
Yeah.
And so essentially we did. And as things moved along and we established the site out at Basil Griffin Park, the county was kind enough to give us a 4-acre section of a property out there at the corner of Three Springs Road and Small House Road. And I need to say this too. So much of what we've done has been donated by people,
right?
Businesses, professional people, architects, engineers, people like that. And we never would have been able to accomplish what we have without those so generous donations of time and expertise that's helped us move along. But anyway, along the way, you do, as a nonprofit, you get into debt because you're going to go ahead and take this next step and bet that you can raise the money necessary to pay off any debt. And so we got into the discussion of finding if the MiG pilot I shot down survived or not, finding out who he was, making contact with him. And the feeling was, well, if we were able to do that, that would give us some publicity, and maybe we could raise money from that, pay off some of our debt.
Yeah.
That was our motivation.
Sure.
But anyway, that's basically what happened. And we did some outreach with everybody we could think of that had connections to Vietnam. And we became acquainted with a young lady. Her name was Tu Yen. And she was a television journalist in Vietnam. And she hosted, anchored basically their nightly news every night. But she also had a monthly program called The Separation Never Seems to Have Existed. And so she heard about my quest to find out whether, first of all, did the MiG pilot survive? Mm-hmm. I thought he did, but you never know. I mean, I flew by him within a couple of hundred feet of him,
right?
And he's in his parachute, it appeared that he survived, but you never know,
right?
And so reached out, and I told her, I sent her an email, and I said, I'd always been curious if he survived or not. And I asked her for her assistance in putting me in contact with him if he survived, and let me communicate with him. That's all I really wanted to do. And so I never, you know, I thought, well, that's probably not going to go anywhere. But it was only a couple of weeks later I received another email from her, and she said, we have found the brave MiG pilot, and we want you to come to Vietnam and meet him on live national television.
Wow.
So that's what happened. But I'll tell you, when I first heard that, I thought, well, this is too good to be true. I mean, it's a setup. They're trying, they're trying to embarrass me or make me do something bad toward my country. And but it wasn't that way at all. So I accepted the invitation and flew to from Nashville to Ho Chi Minh City, and that's when I first met the MiG pilot face to face. And at that time, the way they handled the program was they didn't tell me anything about him other than his name. I had not seen a picture of him or anything. They knew all kinds of things about me,
sure,
because they'd gotten it off the internet. Arrived at the television station, Tu Yen, the host, invited me up on a little stage. There was a pretty sizable studio audience, not monstrous, but pretty good size. And she asked me some basic questions about who I was and why I'm there, what I hope to accomplish, and things like that. And then very dramatically, she introduced Nguyen Hong Mi. And over on the other side of the studio, out from behind a partition, out stepped this man. And again, I'd never seen him before. But he appeared to be somebody that came out of central casting from a Vietnamese fighter pilot movie or something.
Right.
He was not very tall, but you could tell very muscular. He was dressed in a dark business suit with a red tie, and his head was kind of like yours, Jim.
No hair?
No hair. His head is totally shaved.
Right.
And he came walking toward me, and I stood up immediately, and he had a kind of a pleasant look on his face. It wasn't a smile, but it was a pleasant look.
Yeah,
and he came over to me, and I reached out my hand, and we clasped our hands in a very firm handshake. And he said, "Welcome to my country. I'm glad to see that you're in good health, and I hope that we can be friends."
Wow!
And so that's how that all started. It was really a kind of a special moment right then.
Which kind of led to the book, My Enemy, My Friend.
Well, it did eventually. It sure did. When I would tell this story to friends of mine, I would always get, you need to write a book about this.
Right.
And I'd never written a book before, but my good friend, Fran Erickson, who's a wonderful English teacher and a wonderful writer, sort of guided me through the process. And, you know, Jim, the book has been incredibly successful.
Yeah.
It's for sale now at Aviation Heritage Park in their gift shop. I've donated all the proceeds to the museum. Mm. And it's sold over 10,000 copies, which just
amazes
me.
I was going to say, how many times has it been? I know you've had at least 3 printings. I have a first and a third.
Yeah, we do. We've had more printings than that, but there are 3 editions.
That's okay. Right.
The third edition is what's currently on sale.
I got you.
And so if anybody's interested in the book, don't buy it on Amazon. Go out to Aviation Heritage Park and buy it because that's the latest edition. And also all the proceeds go to help the museum and help our new exhibits get created and help the park in general.
So are you still in touch with Hong Mi?
I am. Not too often.
Sure.
But we
only a world apart.
That's true. he's pretty good with email. He has 2 children. He has a daughter and a son. And they are very technologically savvy, and so they help him with things like that. Mm-hmm. But the way we communicate is via email.
Okay.
And my wife passed away almost 2 years ago now, and Hong Mi, he knew Syl because she would travel with us on the several of the trips that we took when we were on a speaking circuit, giving speeches and selling books and mm-hmm. doing things like that. And so I received the sweetest, nicest email from him when Syl passed. And I saved that because it really meant a lot to me.
Sure.
He had spent a lot of time composing it, and it said all the right things just at the right time. So I appreciate it.
Well, and so he is, you know, you are friends now.
Oh, and no question. It's not.
And y'all have a bond. I mean, there's probably not many people in the world that have a bond like you all.
Well, I guess not. And we both feel grateful for it. And it's, again, another circumstance that was guided, I think. Mm-hmm. The fact that the two of us, the chemistry between the two is true and it's honest.
Yeah.
And we're... You know, as he would say, we were just soldiers.
Yeah.
You know, we were just soldiers doing the best we could for our two countries.
Right.
So he doesn't hold, you know, even though he was the loser in the dogfight, he doesn't hold any grudge against me for that. He knows mm-hmm. that was the business we were both in.
Yeah.
And so it was the fact that he came out on the losing side on that particular day back in 1972, he's been able to accept that and get beyond that to establish our friendship.
So beyond your service in the military and the things you've done for this community, Aviation Heritage Park, you also served as the Secretary of the Kentucky Justice Cabinet. Now, which governor was that under?
That was Governor Paul Patton.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Sure was.
And how long did you do that?
I did that for 3 years.
Okay.
During his first term. And then I got hired away to come down and run the initial part of the Kentucky Transpark development. So Judge Buchanan called me up when I was up at Frankfort and said he would really like for me to come down and work on that. And I was kind of glad to get back home. Although I enjoyed my time in state government, I did. I learned a lot, and I was proud of our people and the hard work and the good work they were doing at the time. And it was a very good experience being up there in the Justice Cabinet. And but I was glad to get back to my home in Bowling Green too, and then start on the Transpark. And so, and naturally, as I look at the Kentucky Transpark now.
It's come a long way.
It sure has, and it was sort of painful at the time, but it was all those things are necessary, and I'm so proud of the outcome.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of job growth and economic activity out there, and, you know, just like, you know, the Transpark is an economic driver, so is Aviation Heritage Park. I mean, we have tourists that come in from all over the world to visit the park.
Well, we sure do, and we have, you know, that amazes me, too, is how the credibility of Aviation Heritage Park has grown within the tourism industry. And so we frequently do joint efforts to attract people with the Corvette Museum and the Historic Rail Park.
Mm-hmm.
They have a program called Trains, Planes, and Automobiles.
Yeah.
And people come, you know, they send busloads of folks in from all over. And they'll visit all three museums in one day. And that's been enjoyable for us and something we're proud of to be thought of in the same terms as something as significant as the Corvette Museum or the Historic Rail Park.
Yeah, you know, our transportation history, you know, producing the Corvette, I believe there was another car before the Corvette that was produced in Bowling Green at one time, or parts of it, maybe a Chrysler plant in the mm-hmm. area, but having the train depot, the historic train depot, and all the good things that they're doing out there with the car renovation, the train cars that, mm-hmm. that have been renovated right out there. And then, of course, you get to see some of the old Corvettes out at the Corvette Museum and other vehicles at times they bring in different exhibits. It's just a very unique place.
Well, Bowling Green is a great place to entertain people. I mean, I've
no question.
Yeah, I've been able to attract a couple of different reunions of military organizations here to town, and There's no shortage of things for people to do and to enjoy themselves in our town.
It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. All right, so you talked about your walking group. You still meet Monday through Friday every day?
We do if it's not too cold. We have a cutoff temperature of 20 degrees.
Okay.
It used to be 15 back when we were younger. But now it's 20, and we don't walk as fast, and we don't walk as quite as far.
Yeah.
But
you're still out there.
We're out there, and the most important thing is when we go to McDonald's and solve the world's problems.
Yeah, and you know, that's usually where lots of groups can solve problems like that because, you know, common sense comes into play in a lot of those conversations.
It does.
All right, real quick, if someone wants to support the Aviation Heritage part, how can they help out?
Well, lots of different ways, but there are two primary ways. One is to visit. Mm-hmm. Take your out-of-town guests, take your grandchildren, your children out there. You will be impressed with what you see. There's no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
And the museum itself now is open from 10 until 4, Tuesday through Saturday. And there's no admission. And you will be totally entertained. So attending is one way to do it. We also have an annual hangar party that's...
I got a band for you, by the way.
Oh, good. Well, we need a band.
Yeah.
But the this year's hangar party is on June the 14th.
Okay.
It'll be out at the Bowling Green Airport in the big hangar that they have out there. And it's a lot of fun. And, Jim, I know you've been there. And,
oh, yeah.
But it's our primary fundraiser. But I can assure you that your audience, everybody, you want to put June 14th on your calendar. And come out, buy a ticket, attend, bring your family.
And it's not formal. It's not like you have to wear a suit and tie. It's very casual.
It is very casual. And it's a barbecue dinner, beverages are served, and we have a lot of static display aircraft, mm-hmm. a very interesting aircraft to look at. And it's just a good feeling when you go out there. It'll make you feel proud of your community and your country when you attend. So those are two of the ways. And, of course, you can always go online to aviationheritagepark.com. You can make a contribution there if you'd like. And that will go to help with the restoration of the F-105, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
There's a campaign going on for that now. It's called 105 Alive. And that'll teach folks, the history of that wonderful airplane. And then you can be on the ground floor of making it into a very amazing exhibit that we'll all be proud of.
And so are you the only one that has two planes that have been flown by you out there?
Well, I guess so. I haven't really thought of it that way, but and I just discovered the fact that I flew that particular airplane.
Yeah.
But the airplane, the exhibit is not to honor me at all. It's to honor a couple of other Kentuckians who distinguished themselves during the Vietnam War flying the F-105.
All right, so I watched the TV show that they did on the dogfight.
Oh yeah,
the History Channel. Mm-hmm. And I the one thing that stood out to me is that when you were talking with your other pilots that were up there, y'all were calling each other by your names. Did y'all not have cool call signs?
Well, you know, I never had some of our guys then had cool call signs. For some reason, I didn't.
Yeah.
And during that time period, now we're talking 1972, right?
Yeah.
It hadn't been assigning a call sign to every single pilot hadn't become officially
a thing
approved by the Air Force. The Navy did it for years.
Uh-huh.
And then, that's something we learned from combat in Southeast Asia, is that identifying who you're talking to, that there's no mistaking. You know, you can't say just because your flight call sign is something that you say, well, that's Basco 2 or 3 or 4, that. So it's much better to have a unique call sign. And if you listen to the video, my wingman was Greg Crane was his name, And his nickname at the time was Baby Beef because he was a little chunky, you know. And
Baby Beef.
And so if you listen to that video, you hear me talking to him, calling him Beef.
Yeah,
just Beef. And but he's calling me by Dan. I don't know why I didn't have one, but I didn't at the time.
Well, did you have one? Did you ever get one?
I never did. I was. You know, I think it had to do with the period I was flying actively and not. But I think the personal call sign that I cherish the most is what I was referred to when I was on the Thunderbird team, and they still today call me Boss.
Okay.
And because I was a commander and the leader of the team, but they call me Boss, and it makes me feel good when they do, even today. You know?
So you were the commander and leader of the Thunderbirds. Tell us about that experience, and how long did you do that?
Well, I did it for 2 years, actually 2.5 years, and and it was a tremendous honor, probably the hardest job I ever had.
Yeah, y'all fly really close to each other.
Well, we do, but we train for that as well. And but as the commander, you know, you're responsible for the whole operation. Mm-hmm. So. And the squadron had to be self-sufficient even on the road. I mean, we were traveling close to 200 days a year. We were out on the road, flying air shows all over the country. And but I think back on those days, and I'm very proud of the fact that I was selected, but it was something I never anticipated. But what a tremendous honor it was to be able to represent our Air Force to the general public that way.
Yeah.
And my team, and as you might imagine, because of the challenges of the job, you become very close, like family. And so we still get together. We try to get together, my team, the ones of us that are left, we try to get together every year. And now we call ourselves the Thunder Geezers.
Thunder Geezers.
Yeah, we're the Thunder Geezers, and we're proud of that. But it's amazing how quickly... You know, after you may not have seen each other for a year or more, but yet when you get back together because of that initial closeness we enjoyed, we're right back to where we were in just a matter of 5 minutes.
Well, there's just so much we could talk about. I mean, we're not even going to touch on, you know, your connections to Western Kentucky University and, you know, your involvement there. But just great honor to have you on the podcast, General Cherry. Right. And you know, I've had Mike Buchanan, I've had Johnny Webb, and I've had Jody Richards on the podcast. And I kind of put you guys in my community first group because you and those that I've just mentioned have always been about the community, and we're truly grateful for that because you are part of the reason that makes this area such a special place. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's been a pleasure being with you today and telling these stories, and I hope it means something to your audience.
It will. General Cherry, thanks for being on the DeCesare Group podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Brigadier General Dan Cherry for being on the DeCesare Group podcast, and thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, please share it with a friend. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, leave us a review, and share your feedback with us. We drop a new episode every other Monday. You can also follow the DeCesare Group across all of our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and X. The DeCesare Group podcast is produced by the DeCesare Group, a public relations and consulting firm based in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Our engineer is Justin, call sign Gusterson, DeCesare, with content contributions from Brooke Mattingly, and our researcher and writer is Amy DeCesare. I'm Jim DeCesare, and join us again next time for the DeCesare Group podcast.